The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and it is my honor to introduce Debbie Maycumber this evening. One of the most popular writers in the world, Debbie Maycumber is the author of more than 150 books. Her romantic, heartening, and hopeful stories of small-town life, lasting friendships, and home and family have won her millions of fans and a raft of honors, including more than a few number one spots on the New York Times bestsellers list. Her inspiring novels have spent nearly 800 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. Spring is in the air in the latest installment in her beloved Blossom Street series. Wedding bells are ringing, and the baby blanket window display in a Good Yarn knitting store is changing lives in unexpected ways. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Debbie Maycumber.
Well, hello, everyone. It's really good to be here. Thank you for coming tonight on a rainy, cold night. I was at a knitting conference just recently and went out for lunch, and oftentimes you forget you have your badge with your name on it. Well, I certainly did, and went into a restaurant with a friend for lunch, and the waitress came up, and she looked at me, and she looked at the name tag, and she said, "Oh, my goodness, you have the same name as my favorite author." It's really hard to look like your publicity photo. I'm just telling you right now. Most everybody wants to know how I got started writing, so I'll tell you the story in a kind of a condensed version. I always wanted to be a writer. When I was a little girl, I used to go to sleep at night making up stories in my head, and I didn't learn to read until I was 10 years old, and I struggled all through school because I'm dyslexic, and they just didn't have a word for it, or teachers didn't recognize it then as the way they do now. In fact, I didn't know I was dyslexic until my sons were diagnosed with it. The third grade teacher told my mom, "Debbie's a nice little girl, but she's never going to do well in school," and I didn't. The only way I can think to explain it to anybody is the joy I would feel when I would think about being a writer. If you burn yourself, you throb with pain. But every time I would think about telling stories and writing books, I throbbed with joy. There was this happy, exciting anticipation that would come over me. But when you have such a negative school background the way I did, it's very easy to stuff your dreams into the future, and that's exactly what I did. I married shortly after I graduated from high school. Wayne and I had 4 children in 5 years. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I would dreamed of being that writer, but it's very easy to just put it off. So it was a tragic event in our family. One of my cousins I was very close to died. And it was as if God was saying to me, "You cannot push your dreams into the future. If you want to do something, do it now." So we rented a typewriter, put it on the kitchen table. The 2 older kids would go off to school. And Supermom turned into that struggling young writer. And I was taking $100 a month out of our family budget. That's just how much it cost. It was $25 for the rental of the typewriter. I was taking a correspondence writing class, which is another $25 a month, and supplies and stamps and books and paper. It were averaged out to about. And I used to feel really guilty about that. But in retrospect, I realized that I taught our children some of the most valuable lessons of their childhood. And I'd been writing for about 2.5 years. I really loved what I was doing. I was a better wife. I was a better mother. I was a happier person. And one
Wayne is a construction electrician, and he'd been out of work for several months, and he just came to me and he said, "Honey, we just can't do it anymore. I'm sorry, we're just going deeper in debt every month, and I really need you to get a job." Now, I have no job skills, absolutely none, but I circled three jobs I thought I could get, and I would apply for the next day. But I knew that I was going to have to give up the dream of being a writer because I couldn't keep up with the house and with the kids, and they were in sports and scouts and dance and music and, you know, so many other activities that working 40 hours a week with them and the house, I knew that I was going to have to give up being a writer. There just weren't enough hours in the day. So I went to bed that night, and my heart was so heavy. And I just couldn't sleep. And Wayne woke up about 3 or 4 in the morning, and he said, "Are you asleep?" I said, "No, I haven't been asleep yet." And he says, "Well, what's wrong?" And I said, "You know, I really think I could have made it as a writer. I do." And he didn't say anything for a long time. And then he sat up and he turned on the light and he said, "All right, honey, go for it. Go for it." So, you know, I wish I could say I'm just so talented that I sold right away, but it was another 2.5 years. But I did decide I had to at least bring in the $100 that I was taking out of our family budget. So I started submitting articles and little anecdotes. I'll tell you the first thing I sold, it was our son Dale was in the Christmas program. He was 5 years old, and all he had to do was to step forward and recite his Bible verse and step back. And he did it flawlessly. He just did such a good job. But then in a moment of panic, he forgot the reference. Well, this poor little boy looks to me like, "Help me, Mom, help me." So I went, "It's Luke, it's Luke." Dale straightens his shoulders and he goes, "Luke Skywalker." So I got $5 for that, five incredible dollars. And it felt like so much money because it was validation. And I tell writers this all the time, celebrate those little successes along the way. You know, it's very nice when we get money for even the smallest things. The next thing I sold, I got $35. You can see me just coming right up the food chain with that. Our son Ted had this spiritual awakening where God answered a prayer, and he was so excited. He came in and he said he was going to be a missionary for Jesus. And I said, "Ted, that's just great. Don't go any farther in darkest Africa. Be home by dinner time." So Wayne comes home from work and he says, "Have you seen Ted lately?" And I said, "Yeah, he's out riding his bike." He said, "No, Debbie, he is on the corner preaching." So I went out to collect him for dinner, and in the sidewalk he had written in chalk, "Jesus loves you, ask Ted." So I got $35 for that. And then I sold to Women's Day magazine, $350. So, I mean, I can remember how proud I was when I handed Wayne that check, because that was a whole extra week's pay for us. And I can remember the big smile that came over my husband. He said, "This could work out, honey. This could really work out." And, you know, $350 was, we live from paycheck to paycheck. We never had $350 extra. And it felt like so much money. We thought we should like pay off the house. I mean, it just was, you know, what are we going to do with all this extra money? And Wayne very wisely said, "Why don't you go to a writer's conference?" To this point, I had never met another writer in the world. And I was submitting my things to New York, and they were rejected so fast, they hit me in the back of the head on the way home from the post office. So it was, you know, one of those things. So I found a writer's conference, and I signed up for it. It cost $100. I took $100 out of that, and found out that two editors from the very house that I had been submitting to were going to be at this conference, and they had agreed to review 10 manuscripts. So I submitted mine, and mine was one of the 10. Now, I don't have ESP or any premonitions or anything like that, but when I got that letter telling me that my manuscript had been chosen, I had the most incredible feeling come over me that I was going to sell this book. And I loved this story. I had to learn to be a writer. The gift God gave me is that of being a storyteller. And if this book didn't sell, I didn't think anything I ever wrote would sell because this was so good. And I walked into the conference, and it was a room like this, and every seat was full. And those of us, the 10 of us who were having our manuscripts reviewed, had a star on our badge. I was so proud. It was like I had a size 52 left breast. I mean, I was like, that's me. And the editor who had read mine came out, and she said, "One of the manuscripts that I have read shows incredible promise." And I swear to you, it was all I could do not to raise my hand and say, "That would be me." It wasn't. It really wasn't. She had the whole room laughing at what she called the infeasibility of my plot. Now, if she'd said anything about the writing being immature, I could have accepted that. I knew I had to learn to be the writer. But for her to tell me the story was no good, that hurt. But I decided that I had to be willing to do whatever it took. So I went up to her afterwards, humbled beyond belief, and told her who I was and the title of my story. And I asked her, if I rewrite it, would you be willing to give me another chance? Would you look at it again? And now, oh my goodness, it's over 30 years ago now. But even now, I don't think I'll ever forget the look that came over her as she leaned forward and put her hand on my arm and said, "Throw it away." 5 years I'd been writing, and the best I could do, she was saying, "Throw it away." Now, Wayne was out of work, just a common thing in our lives, and was waiting up in Alaska to go out on the pipeline, and the kids and I were living on his unemployment check of $150 a week. I didn't even bother to go to bed that night. I sat up all night long. And, all those ugly voices from when I was growing up were taunting me. You know, having a creative imagination can be a real negative thing, too. And they were saying, "So you think you're going to sell a book? So you think you're going to be a writer? Debbie's a nice little girl, but she's never going to do well. Debbie, you're going to have to stay in at recess until you can improve your spelling." All those things from my youth were just shouting at me. And I thought, I can't do this. I just can't do this anymore. But I thought, okay, if I ever needed to think positive, it was then. So I reached for the most positive book in the world, in my view, and that's my Bible. And the reading for the day was John 14. The first verse says, "Let not your heart be troubled." And I thought, oh God, you have got a sense of humor. And the last verse said, "Arise, let us go from here." So I arose and I went right back to that writer's conference and I wanted a refund. And they wouldn't give it to me. And I thought, by golly, I am not going to waste this money. But everything I had sold at this point had to do with the children. So I decided maybe this is God's less than subtle way of letting me know I should be writing for kids. So I sat in a children's writing workshop. There were three people on the panel, an editor, an agent, and an author. The editor got up and said, "This is the worst time ever to be selling a children's book." The agent got up and said, "I haven't sold anything in months." And then the writer got up and said, "How many of you made $25,000 last year writing? Please raise your hand." Well, nobody did. And she said, "Do this." Now, I don't remember everything she said except one thing. Do not leave a rejected manuscript on your desk. It needs a home. Your job is to find it. So I went, that little bit of hope, that tiny bit of encouragement, I grabbed onto it with both hands. I went home and I wrote what's known as a query letter to another publisher. And in the query letter, you just say, "This is the plot of my book. If you'd like to see it, let me know and I'll mail it to you." And every day, I waited for a response. And every day, the mailbox was just full of bills. And finally, one day, I didn't care if New York wanted this manuscript or not. I was mailing it off because I could not stand to listen to those voices shouting at me any longer. Now, if I've ever seen God's hand in my life, and I have many times, this is probably one of the most profound moments. I loaded the kids in the station wagon. We drove down to the post office. And as I stood in line there, my stomach was in knots. I knew it was going to cost $10 to mail that manuscript. And when you are living on a $150 week unemployment check, $10 is a lot of money. And by the time I got up to the front of the line, I handed the postmaster the money. I'm thinking, oh God, I hope I'm doing the right thing. And he says, you have to let go of the money. Let go! So, and then I came home, and the kids are in the car, and my son Ted runs down to the mailbox, and he said, Mom, Mom, there's a letter for you. And I knew right away it was the answer to my query letter. I stood right in the middle of the street, tore open the envelope, and in a Sharpie pen, the editor had written right across the face of my query letter, do not mail us your manuscript. We are not buying. I went in the house and I lay down on the Davenport, and I swear to you, the house could have burned down and I wouldn't have moved. I have never been that depressed in my life. Okay, I hadn't had teenagers yet. 3 weeks later, September 29th, 4:39 in the afternoon, the editor called and bought the book. If I had waited a half hour, I would never have mailed off the manuscript. Then, because I had written four books all the way through, all of the stories were good. I sold every one of those stories. I had to rewrite the books because the writing was immature, but I was learning and growing as a writer. So, how many of you have ever written me? Has anybody here ever written me? Oh, thank you. Thank you. I love getting mail. And I have gotten some wonderful, incredible letters from readers over the years. And I hope you don't mind if I share just a few with you of the love I have gotten from my readers. I love your books so much, I'm willing to pay for them. Now, you have to believe she was a library patron. Which, and I love to tell this story because when I was a little girl, my mom took me to the library. I was about 4 or 5 years old. And it was one of the old Andrew Carnegie libraries that were built in stone. And even then, I had a creative imagination because I pictured myself as a princess going into the library. And the librarian handed me the book, and my mother said, I grabbed hold of it with both hands and put it right next to my heart. And she said, from that point forward, I would never go down for a nap without a book in my hand or a magazine or something to look at and read. And I'm that way today. Now, that's a great story in itself, but the librarian who handed me that book was Beverly Cleary. So, now, I get a lot of mail because I tend to write books in a series, and this is pretty typical. When is that next Cedar Cove book coming out? I'm 85. Hurry! Now, I never had the opportunity to attend college, but I like to think of myself as well-read and self-taught until I got this letter. I like your books best because you use small words. So, this is one of my favorites. You're my favorite author. You put me to sleep every night. You don't even need Ambien. Just read me. And then this one came from my editor. And I was actually one of the very first authors to ever have their mailing address in a book because I love getting mail. And the reader's feedback has changed the course of my career about 4 or 5 different times. But this letter came from my editor, and it was 3 pages long. And the woman had put the title of my book on the right-hand side of the page. And on the left-hand side of the page, she put all the ways she thought I could have improved it. And the last line of her letter was, in fact, I have read every one of Debbie Maycomber's books, and I haven't liked a one of them. I told her to just keep buying the books. I'd try harder. And I have gotten a proposal of marriage. A woman contacted me and said, "You sound like such a nice person, just the kind of woman I want my son to marry. He's 52 and lives at home. Are you interested?" Not really, but thanks anyway. And this is another one of my favorites. It's a woman wrote and said, "I would buy anything that has your name on it. So thank you, Betty, for writing such great books." And if you have your mailing address in anything that's available to men in prison, trust me, you will get mail. And they are silver-tongued devils. They have learned to function by manipulation. So they will say anything that they think you want to hear. Well, this guy could take lessons, because the letter he wrote me is, "You can be my woman. I don't even care that you're fat." Now we're going to give you the opportunity to ask questions, but I'm going to answer some even before you ask, because I get them all the time. Are any of your kids going to be writers? Any one of them could be. They're all very creative, but they don't have the passion. And if you want to anything as badly as I wanted to be a writer, you have to have the passion. But my 8-year-old grandson shows all the characteristics of being a writer. When he was 8, his school was vandalized, and he was so upset about it. He did what writers do instinctively. He sat down and he wrote a story. And in the story, he was instrumental in capturing the culprits. And the last line of his story is, "When they got out of jail, they were too old for bingo." That's good. That's really good. And I said, "James, can Grandma use that line?" Now, here's the test of being a real writer. He said, "If you pay me." And a lot of people want to know about my husband, Wayne. And I wish he was here. He isn't. He's in Florida right now. We're going to meet in Seattle tomorrow. But Wayne is a wonderful guy, and he has supported and loved me. We've been married 46 years this year. So, I'm very blessed with him. He's got, the best way I can think to, he's got a very dry sense of humor. He's very witty, and he's just the opposite of me. I'm a people person, and he's shy and introverted. So, but he's got this wonderful sense of humor. We were going to Weight Watchers. And, if you followed my publicity photos or followed me, my weight goes up and down. I kind of consider myself the Christy Alley of the literary world. And he's rubbing my back down, and he says, "Honey, you're getting an hourglass figure." "Okay, an hour and 15 minutes. I did a 20-city tour for a book titled 20 Wishes. And Wayne said, "Debbie, if you'd have titled that 3 Wishes, you'd have been home a long time ago." And he's a man's man. You know, he's a big construction worker, and him and his buddy Norm do manly things together, and they're going out in the woods with their guns and their dogs, and their dogs' names are Ruffles and Peterkins. And I can tell you, when I hear Wayne, I signed Wayne and I up for ballroom dancing classes. Now, as I explained, Wayne is not a ballroom dancing kind of guy. But by golly, I have sailed the seas. I have climbed mountains. I have ridden motorcycles for this man. He could take ballroom dancing classes. And he complained and griped. And finally he said, "All right, what's it going to cost me to buy my way out of this? Take a look at these diamonds, girls." I don't sell cheap. So, and then another question I always get is about Port Orchard, which is based on the TV series Cedar Cove from my series of books. What is Port Orchard really like? I can tell you 3 things about Port Orchard. And this is stuff you couldn't make up. The dollar store had a sale. And we, because the Cedar Cove series, the titles are all street addresses, I was looking at street names all the time, and I bet you I had driven past this street 1,000 times and never noticed. Easy Street. And so Wayne was driving, and I said, "Honey, turn. I want to see what Easy Street's like." And he looks at me and he said, "It isn't going to be different than any other street." "Well, yes, it is. It's a dead end."
Easy Street, Port Orchard is a dead end. Now, the only thing I can, the best way I can describe this is, in Port Orchard, we have a Chinese laundryman who I love dearly, but his name begins with an X, and I swear to you, it's 25 letters long, and I massacre it every time I try to say it. Being dyslexic, foreign languages are more difficult for me, and especially difficult names. And so the last time I was in there, he got a big smile on his face, and he said, "I choose an American name." I said, "Oh, I'm so glad. What's your American name?" "Jose!" So Port Orchard has a Chinese laundryman named Jose. So, okay, I'm ready to answer any questions you have for me.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm good.
Welcome back to the Philly area.
Thank you.
My name is Yvette Jiggets. We've met several times at Crochet Guild of America and knitting conferences. I wanted to ask you, it's about, I want to say maybe 7 to 10 years ago, we were at Valley Forge for the Knitting and Crochet Guild.
Stitches, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you had told us a story at that time about a young lady who you adopted. She was in the armed services.
Yes.
Wanted to know, I have been following you all that time, and I don't know if you remember, we took a picture together and I made a frame for you and sent you the picture of us together.
Yes, I have it.
And my son, Joseph, who was a teenager, went with us to Minnesota and helped you with your bags and all of that. But I wanted to ask you about that young lady because you never mentioned her again. I did see you talk about your biological children, but whatever to that happened.
I have not heard from her, so I don't know. I haven't heard from her about 5 years. She came and spent a summer. It was a young girl that I mentored in Port Orchard, who she wanted to be a writer too. So, and she had quite a story. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I haven't heard from her in about 5 years. I don't even know how to get a hold of her now. So.
About your involvement with Cedar Cove on the Hallmark Channel, are you involved in it on a daily basis? Or
not a daily basis, but I am quite involved with it. In fact, my son was up on the set yesterday, and he played a role. He's actually going to be. So when you see the Cedar Cove series, and when they're in the restaurant, there's this very tall, good-looking kid. Well, he's not a kid anymore, but he's one of the patrons there. Ted was also in the pilot for the Cedar Cove series. He was, if you remember, there is a, and this actually is part of Port Orchard, we have an annual seagull calling contest, and I put that in the book, and they put it in the series, and Ted was one of the contestants. He wore the pirate hat and the pink feather boa. But I am involved. I've certainly been on the set any number of times, and I've met all of the actors. I read all of the scripts. They have what's known as a showrunner, and I'd never heard this term before, but they are the person who plots the season, and they have an actual arc to the season, and people have complained to me that it isn't following the books. Well, they're different mediums. TV and books are different mediums. And we, you know, Andy McDowell is the star of the series. So every episode revolves around her because she's the star. You don't go from book to book to book the way I do. But, you know, the stories all involve her and her friend Grace and the little world that I created of Cedar Cove. Last week, I was... the doorbell rang, and here was this huge bouquet of flowers. And nobody sends me flowers. My publishers, every once in a while, you know, when I have something, you know, really exciting happen, but not that often. And I just couldn't imagine who would be sending me flowers. And it was from Andy McDowell. And they were beautiful. And she said, "Thank you for the part of Olivia, for writing the books about Olivia. I love playing this role." So that was really touched my heart, yeah. So,
hi, Debbie.
Hi.
Is there going to be another Mrs. Miracle book?
No, but I just finished writing a book. Well, I may, you know, you never know. A book called Mr. Miracle. And this came about last Easter. Dan Wigetow, who is the executive, who is the producer of the Cedar Cove series in four of my movies, was telling me that he had been in Hollywood and Henry Winkler had said he'd like to meet me. And I was all excited because I love Henry Winkler. Henry Winkler is also dyslexic.
And he'd heard that I was too. So he was very excited, and I was very excited. And Dan says, we need to come up with an idea for a role for him. And that's where Mr. Miracle came from. And now I've written the book, and the movie has been contracted, and it's a backdoor, which I'm not even sure what that means, but a backdoor to another TV series. So, and Henry Winkler has done a pilot for ABC, so I don't know if we're going to get him or not, but another name that's been tossed out is Nathan Lane. So he would do really good too. But my heart is set on Henry. So, but there, you know, I never know if there's going to be another Mrs. Miracle or another Shirley Goodness and Mercy. It's just whatever idea floats my way. Yeah.
First of all, I'll admit that my favorite series is The Cedar Cove, but I also love Shirley Goodness and Mercy. Get a big kick out of them. But what I was wondering, with the characters in Cedar Cove, is do you have any plan to go further with them in depth? I mean, I know they've occasionally appeared in some of your other books, but do you have any plan to continue the series as it was?
Not as it was. The problem with the Cedar Cove series is that you got so many characters, you know, the first few pages. And I never intended that. It just kind of went on and on and on. So I decided to develop a series set in Cedar Cove, which is called The Inn at Rose Harbor, or The Inn Harbor. And so some of the characters will make appearances, but I have to be very careful because legally now Cedar Cove belongs to Hallmark. So I can only introduce certain characters. So. Yeah, so, but, you know, I'm really loving the Inn, I hope you are too, the Rose Harbor. I can tell you something, though. When I love something, I know the readers are going to love it. I discovered that there is, I hate the word magical, but I really can't think of another word to describe it, a connection between the author and the reader. I know if I laugh when I'm writing a scene, you will laugh too. And if I cry, you will. And if I put my heart out on the page, it links with yours. It is really magical. Yeah.
Will Hallmark put out that Cedar Cove series on DVD like they put some of their movies out?
Yes. You know, it will be available in July. I'm not sure when in July. I heard the 12th. I heard the 29th. I also heard that the second season is going to start July 1st, but I don't know. The author's the last to know.
Most of your novels are set in the Seattle area, but I have to say the very first book that I read of yours was the first in the Dakota trilogy.
Oh,
I had been to South Dakota over 10 years ago, and I was intrigued by the titles, and I really enjoyed them. Do you ever plan to write novels that are set in other areas besides the Seattle area in the future, such as the Dakota series?
I don't know. I did the Dakotas because my mom and dad came from the Dakotas. My mom was born and raised in Dickinson, and my dad in Ipswich, South Dakota. So, you know, it was a tribute to my parents, so that's the reason I did the Dakotas. And I had gone out there as a kid, you know, we'd drive out every other summer or so to the Dakotas, so I was pretty familiar, although I did travel out there again. Yeah, and I loved writing those books, too.
Hi. Are you going to teach a course in writing so we could all do as wonderfully as you are doing?
Well, I can tell you what I did, how I got started. Because remember, I didn't know another writer in the world. But there were several books that I had read that I could read again, again, and again. And whatever that was in those books that I loved so much that I could go back and reread them, I wanted in my own books, and I didn't know how to get it. So I just did what I did in biology class. I dissected them. I read through them, and I divided them by scene, chapter by chapter. And in the process of doing that, I learned the structure of a novel. I learned about how to introduce characters, how to introduce backstory, how to open and close a chapter. And it was a valuable lesson that I learned in writing. It was my four book, you know, and I ended up writing four complete novels all the way through before I sold. So it was just a good way to get started.
Is Blossom Street going to sell to Hallmark or any place?
I wish it would, but I don't know. I don't know. You know, I think all my books make great movies, but I don't know. We just got the deal for Mr. Miracle, so. But I love that Blossom Street series. Although I got to tell you, I'm going to end it. Yeah, I'm getting to, you know, I'm writing 2.5 books a year, and I kind of want to slow down and travel some more. Wayne is turning 70 this year, and I'm taking him on a Greek cruise. He's always wanted to go on a Greek cruise. And then this summer, I'm going to Africa, to Kenya, with a team from World Vision. And both of those trips, you know, that takes quite a bit of time out of it, because it's more than just the time away. It's the downtime after I get back. To get so I kind of need to slow down a little bit.
Debbie, I'm just amazed how you came to where you are in your life, because I read your very first book when you talked about the horrible childhood that you had in school and everything, and I was wondering, because you overcame those obstacles, if you ever thought about going into the schools to tell your story and to inspire children who are struggling. Because I, too, I love creative writing, and I used to tell a lot of stories and use my own imagination. It was my great escape, yeah. And I still aspire to be a writer.
I think that the making up the stories was my great escape, too. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of that. I do talk to schools and kids, and especially the kids that are dyslexic, because I tell them they have a gift. That's why I love Malcolm Gladwell's latest book, David and Goliath, so much, because he explains that being dyslexic isn't really a disability, it's a gift. And once you find, if you're a dyslexic or know somebody who is dyslexic, once you find your gift, you will soar. And that's what happened to me. I had this God-given talent, this God-given gift. And once I found it and latched onto it and stuck with it, I soared. In fact, I got it. And I know this girl, so I know she didn't mean this in a negative way. It's somebody I went to high school with. And I got a letter from her recently, and she said, "Debbie, who would have ever believed you would be as successful as this?" And it's true. I mean, if they'd have given out an award for the least success, the least person to succeed, it would have been me. I mean, I graduated near the bottom of my class. I'm just so grateful I graduated. You know? Yeah. As you might have guessed, I'm just downright friendly, so you can just imagine.
Do you have a favorite of your series?
Oh, my goodness, that's like asking if I have a favorite child. Oh. Yeah, you know, every one of them is special to me in a different way. I never intended to do the ongoing series. The books that I wrote in series before, I wrote 6 books set in Alaska, because Wayne loved Alaska so much that he wanted to take me there, and I thought, what better way to go than to go up there and you know, as a write-off. So I traveled up to Alaska. I had 6 books set in Alaska, 6 books in Texas, 4 books in North Dakota, and every one of those books I had outlined from beginning to end. I knew every scene of every book before I wrote word one of book one, and because I like to have that structure. It's important to me to have that structure when I sit down to write a book. And the readers, even now, I will get letters from readers, and these books were published 20 years ago. They say, "Whatever happened to this character? Could you go back to North Dakota?" You know, those kind of things. And it's like, duh, get smart here. The readers don't want to leave these places that I've created. So the Cedar Cove series was the very first series that I wrote, and I just decided I would just let those books take me wherever they went. So, and it all came from the Cedar Cove cookbook came from you as my readers. I would get mail that would say, "Do you happen to have that recipe for Terry Polgar's macaroni and cheese?" And yes, I did happen to have it. And I just kind of saved those letters and sent them to my publisher and said, "You know, we really need to do a cookbook." And it's the very first cookbook they ever published, and it hit the New York Times list. And that's, it all came from the readers looking for those recipes. So, yeah.
Could you tell me when you're going to re-release Return to Promise in paperback?
You know, it isn't up to me.
It isn't. It's all done with the publisher. They're the ones who decide that. I'm sorry. They just, you know, I have no say. And what they're doing, and I want to educate the readers, is my former publisher will take two books that I wrote early in my career and put them together, put a new cover, and give them a new title. So you have to be very careful when you see these paperback books out there with my name on them. If it has a DM on it, it's a new book, first time published. And if not, if you look inside, you'll see by the ISBN numbers the year it was published. And almost always they are going to be reissues. If you haven't read them, by all means read them. I've been refreshing them and updating them as best I can. So, because, you know, when I started writing in the 80s, who would have believed that there would be cell phones, you know? If there were cell phones, even thinking about them, they were the size of a shoebox, you know? So I'm trying to refresh them and update them so that it isn't jarring. So, you know, why didn't you just call her on a cell phone, you know? But there's a lot of cell phones that need to be charged in these old books. So, that's it.
How many hours a day do you write, and have you converted from your typewriter to a computer?
Oh, yes, I did. I wrote 8 books on a typewriter you could lift with one finger until the S went kapooey. You know, a lot of people don't understand. Writing is a business. I have a business office. I have 7 employees now, and I go to my office every day. I'll start out my day. My grandparents were farmers. And I was born with that early morning happy gene. I just wake up happy. Poor Wayne, he's a night owl. And, you know, when we were first married, he just said, "Do you have to shine so bright in the morning?" Poor guy. So I get up at 4:30, and then I have been writing in my journal from the time I was in grade school. From the time I started writing, I had a journal or a diary. In fact, my first sale was due to my brother and 2 of my cousins who made copies of my diary when I was in the 8th grade and sold it to the boys in my class. So I write in all my journals. I do my Bible reading. And then I go to the pool and I swim a half mile in the pool. And a half mile in the water is a lot farther in the water than it is on land. I want you to know that. And then I go home, have breakfast, and shower, and get dressed, and I go to the office, and the first thing I do is read every piece of mail that comes into the office, and there are guest book entries as little as 25 and as many as 700 a day. And I read everything. If there's a big batch, I'll take them home. But I read every letter and every guest, because you, as my readers, what you say to me is so important. And then I go upstairs, I answer emails, and it is probably 9 or 10 o'clock before I ever get to writing. And then I plot out how many pages I need to write every day to meet my deadline, and I don't go home until those pages are done. Sometimes I'm done about 2 o'clock, and then sometimes I'm done not until 6, but I stay there until those pages are done. I learned something from my doctor, and this has been a real help to me in my career. He takes Wednesdays off. I think he goes and plays golf and does whatever. So I could never get an appointment on Wednesday, but I thought, what a good lesson this was for me. So I write 4 days a week. And on Wednesday, if I go out to lunch, it's on a Wednesday. If I have a dentist appointment or a nail appointment or whatever, it's always on a Wednesday. Those are the days Now, I write as many pages in 4 days as I used to write in 5, because I was always having to hurry out of the office for one reason or another. So Wednesdays are my day off.
Do you have some favorite authors that you could mention?
You know, I read across the board. Because I am dyslexic and such, even now, a very slow, thoughtful reader. And if you see me ever reading a book, I kind of do it with my finger. Because I have to just do it that way. I'm very slow. So I listen to audiobooks, and it's great because I can do more than one thing. You know, it's good time management for me. And I have audiobooks in the car, in my bathroom, in the kitchen. They're all over. And I never lose track of what story I'm listening to either. And I just read across the board. I read just about everything that's on the New York Times list, because I want to know what people are buying and reading and why. But I will tell you something I learned early on in my career. Because I am a storyteller, I have ideas all the time. I had to find a way to gauge which would be the best story to tell, because I couldn't write everything that I thought of. So I came up with 5 words. So it's a plot premise. So like I get an idea and I'll say, okay, is this relevant to my reader? Is this going to be provocative? I want my readers to think. You know, I'm not going to hit you over the head with anything, with knowledge or anything else, because heaven knows I'm not that smart. But I want my reader to think. If I the book 20 Wishes, if you were going to have 20 wishes, what would they be? So this relevant, provocative, creative. I want to tell the story in the most creative way possible. I want it to be realistic, and I want it to be entertaining. So if I can put a plot premise up against those 5 words, that's the story I develop. So I don't have that answer to the question, but okay, one more question.
With such a good example, like you as a parent, tell us about the children. What are they doing?
Oh, I do have incredibly gifted, wonderful kids. And I have 9 grandkids, too. 9. Jody is our oldest. And we bought a restaurant and a gift shop. And she's the manager there. So she does that. Our daughter, Jenny Adele, she was born Jenny. And when she turned 40, she decided her name would be Adele. So my husband calls her our daughter, formerly known as Jenny. And she works for me. She is my office manager and my executive officer, she likes to call herself. And she is very, very valuable to me. Our son Ted is a teacher. And our son Dale died 2.5 years ago now. And he also was a teacher. He was a special ed teacher. And the 9 grandkids are probably the most amazing grandkids in the universe. It's a shared title. I know that. So those are our kids. So thank you very much. You've just been a wonderful audience.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.